Spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning and welcome to the 3CR Spoken Word program. My name is Di Cousins and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. So today I'm doing a second program with Robert DiNapoli, talking about his new book, Reading Old English Riddles, The Dark Glass, published by Cambridge Scholars Publishing. Welcome, Bob.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, this is a huge topic, Old English literature, and we might just recap a little bit that the work is written in the Old English language, and that was used in the period between the 5th century and the 11th century,
yeah,
roughly?
Yeah, that's about right.
Mm-hmm. And when did they start writing it down?
Shortly after the arrival of the missionaries, which was 597, they began writing Latin texts down, and then it took another century or two. Basically, it took the Vikings. All of the literacy that the Anglo-Saxons had from the missionaries was Latin literacy. They didn't worry about copying anything in their own language. And it was only after the Vikings began turning up, because, of course, they hammered the monasteries. They were full of, they thought they were full of gold, and they were easy pickings. So the monasteries in particular got hit very, very hard. And by the time of King Alfred in the 800s, he writes pieces where he's lamenting that there's almost no learning left. You know, almost no one who can understand their Paternoster from here to the River Humber, which would be a pretty dire situation. So he instigated a program that kept going for the rest of the Anglo-Saxon period of translation, of getting patristic texts and other vernacular texts copied down in English. And so that starts from the mid-800s. You start getting bulk transcription of vernacular texts.
And what is Paternoster and patristic, just for the, those
I'm
who
sorry.
Don't know?
The Paternoster, that's just the Our Father.
Okay.
So it's the Lord's Prayer in Latin. And then patristic is it's the father word again, and it's used to refer to those leading authorities of the early church, people like St. Augustine, Gregory the Great, there's millions of them, and they're referred to as the church paters, the fathers, and their writings are called patristic because they're written by the fathers.
And what about the ancient Greek learning that was preserved in Arabic texts? When does that get written down in English or Latin? Or
That's a Renaissance thing.
Okay.
Some Anglo-Saxon scholars knew of those cultures, but most of them had very little Greek and wouldn't have been able to read anything, let alone Arabic.
Okay, so that's a long time later.
Yeah.
Yeah, after the Crusades. Hmm.
Well, you know, England's all the way over on one end of Europe, so it takes time for these things to travel.
Right. Anyway, so the riddles that we're reading are a particular Anglo-Saxon form that only exists in this period between the 5th and the 11th century, and then you don't get riddles later on. Is that right?
You do. There are some Middle English riddles as well. They remain a popular genre, which means they often don't get look-ins in major manuscript collections and stuff. They're considered slight productions or for children. And it just the collection that's in the Exeter book that we have, it's nearly 100, probably was 100 riddles, but there's damage at the end of the manuscript where the last section of riddles is. It's clear that the culture valued them a little more highly than that. And most cultures do. Most certainly European cultures and many non-European cultures use the riddle form as a serious form of wisdom discourse, as a way, again, of questioning the world and letting the world question you.
Yes. I mean, and there is always that great example of the riddle in Sophocles.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, Oedipus Rex, mm-hmm. yeah, from the Sphinx.
And... Which is similarly playful because he solves the riddle and the Sphinx kills herself on the one hand, but that's only the start of his troubles. And, of course, he ends by having to solve the riddle of who killed his father. He's going, who did this? I'm going to get him. You know, and he's a detective tracking himself.
Yes, it's a particularly vicious riddle, that one. Mm. Yeah.
Anyway,
we'll go to Inkhorn 1.
Mm-hmm.
And so just for anyone who didn't hear the first program, this is originally written down in Old English.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask you to read it in Modern English and then later to read the Old English.
Okay. So this is Inkhorn. It happens to be Inkhorn 1 because there's two other Inkhorn riddles, but it goes like this. I am a protector to my flock, bound fast with guardian wires, my interior filled by lordly treasure. During the hours of day, I often spit terrible spears. The more I fall, the more I prosper. The well-born man observes how from my belly war darts fly. Sometimes I swallow darkly lustrous battle weapons, bitter points and dire deadly spears. My stomach is excellent, cherished by the bold, the hoard within my belly beautiful. Men remember what passes through my mouth.
And the answer to the riddle is that it's the container of ink, which
is literally an inkhorn.
Yeah, and I mean, an inkhorn isn't something we currently use. We would have an ink pot.
Yeah.
So what's an inkhorn?
The inkhorn is usually the end of the antler of an antlered animal. The ones that are talked about in the other inkhorn riddles are clearly stag antlers. So they wouldn't be that huge, not like a big cow or bullhorn. And they'd be cut off to create a conical container, scored out, and then usually strapped to the edge of the lectern where the ink could be kept conveniently close.
And yeah. Then people are writing with feathers.
Well, with quill pens, yeah. The popular image of someone with a big feather in their hand, that's not what they did, basically, because it would be tickling your nose the whole time while you're trying to write, because they had them up on lecterns in front of them. So they would strip off the feathers. And so it would be the core of the feather that is quite a tough cellulose material that can be carved to a nib and used. And it's like a pencil. You could keep trimming it down to a nub until it was done.
Right. Mm. And so they just keep dipping it into the ink
mm-hmm.
well, which is an inkhorn. So just looking at some of the description of it, sometimes I swallow darkly lustrous battle weapons, bitter points and dire deadly spears. Mm. What does that mean?
Well, think of the inkhorn's life in the scriptorium. It would be imprisoned on the side of the lectern where the scribe is working, and the spears clearly are the quill pens. And they dive into its belly, they come out of it darkly lustrous with the ink, and they dive in again. So it's being stabbed all the time by these quills, is that image.
Yeah, it's another one of these riddles where it's an anthropomorphic personification mm-hmm. and it speaks in the I voice, the first mm-hmm. person. My stomach is excellent, cherished by the bold, the hoard within my belly beautiful. Men remember what passes through my mouth.
Sure, because that's the ink, of course. And earlier in it says, my interior filled by lordly treasure. And that too is the ink, because that's what actually forms the words on the page. And the words on the page are going to be the word of God. They're going to be the words of some church fathers. They're all very good for you. Okay. And so, people benefit from what I dispense in that way. That's the main, conceit of the riddle. So as its levels drop, its success grows greater, because what's leaving the inkhorn is extending the text in whatever the scribe is copying.
Yeah. And we have to remember again, because this is the 9th century, they're writing on vellum, which is a form of dried sheepskin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And are there any other elements to this poem, other kinds of levels of meaning?
Well, the only thing that I would point to, and for this you'd have to look at, this is from the next chapter after the birds, which is about scriptorium implements. So, you know, this a vellum riddle and lots of quill riddles and stuff. And the funny thing about it is that most of the implements that either describe themselves or are described there, they're produced by violence. The other two inkhorn riddles tell the inkhorn's full story, that I used to ride around on a lordly creature and we governed the woods and until I was supplanted by a usurper, which is the new pair of antlers growing on the stag's head. And then enemies grabbed me and eviscerated me. You know, they cored it out. And so it sounds excruciating being made into an inkhorn. And all of the riddles to do with riding have images either of extreme violence like that or fatigue. There's a pen in fingers riddle that describes the scribe who owns the fingers and is holding the pen, practically falling asleep at the quill. He's exhausted by his labors. And if anyone's ever done any extended longhand copying, that kind of concentration is quite exhausting in that way. So the whole culture of the written word is problematized in these, I reckon. And I have a funny feeling this is poetry getting its own back, that this is kind of like that Platonic notion of the spoken word being more alive than the written word, which is fixed on the page and dead. And it tells you one thing, but it can't talk to you.
And do you think that the riddles started off as an oral tradition?
Probably, yeah. I don't see why not, to tell you the truth. I mean, I can't demonstrate that they were. But, you know, most cultures have them in some form or other. So just given the spread of the use of riddles, I expect it would have quite a long genealogy that would go back to pre-literate times.
And there's the bard, and the name for the bard is the scope?
Shop, it would be in Old English, yeah. Which probably related to the verb shupan, which means to shape, so that the minstrel, if you like, or the bard in Anglo-Saxon England is a shaper, a maker, which is exactly what he is in Lull and Scots. He's a makar. And the Greek verb poein, which gives us poetry and poet and all, is another making verb. So it's all of a piece.
So this is a good way to go into our next poem.
Mm-hmm.
So would you like to read the spoken word riddle?
I certainly would. And I'm going to read it in sections and comment on each one after I read it, so everybody can stay focused. So this is commonly solved as the spoken word, and it begins like this. Writings say this creature is obvious, many times seen among the race of men. A peculiar power it wields, greater by far than people comprehend. It searches out every last living thing, then goes its way, never standing still from night to night. But without a home, it wanders far and wide the path of exile, yet no more wretched for that. Okay, I'll pause there and talk about those lines. So our quarry here, our creature that we're trying to track down, is kind of elusive, very mobile. And yet, right, that opening line is a kicker. Writings say this creature is obvious. That could mean a lot of things. First off, the reference to writings is, it's yoritu, which is the Old English word for scripture, basically. And so, you know, the written word says of this creature that it's obvious. We'll come back to that in a moment. It goes everywhere. And again, you can think about the spoken word as, you know, as we're speaking here, you know, your voice, my voice filling this room, and it would go farther if we're not sound baffling around us. It never stands still from night to night, but, you know, it wanders far and wide the path of exile. Now, that's a very key image in Old English poetry. The one place you don't want to wind up is in exile. And it means you're cut off from all your social connections and you have no identity, basically. There is a poem called The Wanderer, which is about someone who's been left alone. And he's borderline psychotic, basically. He's hallucinating in the middle of the North Sea because he's lost all his bearings. And yet this creature, although it wanders far and wide like an exile, it's none the worse for that. So it's kind of beating the rap on exile in that way. Okay, and then we get all the negatives. Now I'll start reading the riddle again. It has no foot or hand. It never touches ground. Has neither one eye, nor two, nor a mouth, nor does it ever speak. And I'm going to underline that speak in a bit, to men. It has no understanding, and writings will declare it is the creature most deprived of all that ever were brought forth, according to kind. Without soul or spirit, it must undertake wide voyages throughout this world of wonder. It has no flesh nor bone, yet it affords great comfort to many men across this earth. It never touches heaven, is barred from hell, yet in the teachings of the Glory King, it lives forever. Okay. Now look at all those negatives. Doesn't have this, doesn't have that, doesn't go here, doesn't go... It virtually doesn't exist at all in this way. It's not an embodied being on the face of the earth like the rest of us in that way. And yet it goes everywhere. It comforts human beings. And then this lovely thing, you know, without a mouth or a body, how could it speak, you know, to begin with? But of course, that's a brilliant misdirection, because if the answer to the poem is the spoken word, and you got to think about that. The words coming out of my mouth, they don't speak. I speak them. You know, the speaker speaks the word. The word doesn't speak itself in that way. So it both is and is not a viable clue in that way. And then, you know, it comforts people across the earth, but it doesn't live anywhere on earth. It doesn't touch heaven. It doesn't touch hell. There's nowhere else to go in the medieval cosmos. That's the whole ball of wax in that way. Okay. Yet in the teaching of the Glory King, it lives forever. And that's the kicker, because you have to unpack who the Glory King is. And that's absolute shorthand everywhere in Old English writing for Christ, basically. That sends you back to the Gospels, where you suddenly, if you think about it, you realize that, you know, we know things Christ said, but that's because somebody else wrote them down. You never see Christ writing in any of those narratives. He may not even have been literate, we don't know. But the point is, he delivered his teachings orally. And, you know, we can start invoking Plato and Socrates if we want to, but we don't have to right now. That's part of the freedom of this creature. All right, it lives in the teachings, i.e. it's oral, more or less. That's its life. And then the poem signs off on how twisty its history is. Because, okay, it lives in the teachings of the Glory King. It would take long to tell. They used the verb to speak earlier. Now we've got this clue is lying. The answer is lying in plain sight here. But it would take long to tell how its life is appointed to go thereafter. So after Christ spoke it, it gets complicated. All right, suddenly it gets taken up by apostles. It gets taken up by church fathers. And the whole thing gets complicated out of all recognition. How its life is appointed to go thereafter, the twisting courses of its appointed fate, that is a complex matter to relate, another speaking verb there. But best of all, this is my absolute favorite bit of this poem, true is anything that signifies about this creature in words. It has no limbs, and even so it lives. If you can speak and answer in reply with valid words immediately, then say what it is called. And this is the punchline. It's basically, if the answer is the spoken word, and you pose this riddle to me, and I answer, refrigerator, as long as I've spoken it, that answers the riddle. I.e., as long as you answer it with a spoken word, you can't go wrong.
Yes, it's extraordinary, isn't it? The way that spoken word is personified and visualized as something that's spoken but without a body, but, you know, it's the spoken word itself is separate to the speaker, and you know, it has a life of its own. And I mean, and the fact that the life of Christ is an oral tradition that is later written down. I mean, similarly, the teachings of the Buddha are an oral tradition that are later written down some centuries
later.
This is
a very Zen poem in some ways, for what that's worth. I think, too, imagine, too, a deluxe medieval manuscript, say, of the Gospels or something. You know, that would be a weighty tone, but also resplendent. It would have all this artistry, gold leaf, you know, colored inks, the calligraphic hands and
lapis
all. And go back to the beginning where it says, writings say that this creature is negligible. You know, what's a spoken word? It's a puff of air. I think Anthony Burgess titled a book on the English language, A Mouthful of Air. You say it, it's here, it's gone. Or is it? But it's not here in the way that the book is here, and books seem here to get a bit sniffy. Well, what is this thing, the spoken word? You know,
yeah.
look at me. You know, come back in 100 years, I'll still be here. Where's your spoken word? Well, it's gone into the minds and souls of all the hearers and possibly changed their lives, would be one way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, and just to be a little bit contemporary, mm-hmm. there used to be a little bit of a discussion between page poets and performance poets,
sure.
and a lot of status given to page over performance by some and the reverse by others. But I always feel that poetry should be able to be spoken,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be heard and to be
I mean,
felt.
Just to be very obvious, what's the name of this program, Doc?
Well, that's what I'm trying to say, yes. So we are on the spoken word program.
Yes.
So we have a particular value for the spoken word on this program. So, yeah, I mean, but it's not something you can take for granted because mm-mm. it is so easy to say, well, where's the contract? Put it in writing, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's about fixity. You know, that's about lawyers wanting words to mean one thing and one thing only, which is a valid thing if you're doing contract law, but otherwise it's a graveyard, pretty much. Look, one experience I've had, you know, I've said I'm a retired but active academic because I still teach people on Zoom a lot, and I'm doing it the way I want to do it, not the way I had to do it at university. And one thing I find in conversation over, especially old texts, with people I'm helping to open up the texts with, that in the exchange between two people, three people, four people, these things come alive in a way that they, I mean, I'm a good reader of old English. You can sit me down with an old English book and I can read it on the one hand, but it's not the same as what emerges from the exchange.
Yep.
Between interlocutors, and that's where it really comes to life. And I think this riddle maker of this particular riddle knew that to some extent.
Yes, there's the living quality to the spoken word, which, you know, perhaps goes to this text which says it would take long to tell how mm-hmm. its life is appointed to go thereafter, the twisting courses of its appointed fate. So it's very much embodied as a living thing, the spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were translating these texts, mm-hmm. did they have solutions already or conventions about
Look, there's
what
a lot,
they were? Or?
There's a fair amount of scholarship out there, and much of it has been devoted to establishing agreed upon solutions. And I would say maybe slightly more than half of the riddles have been solved to more or less everyone's satisfaction.
Yeah.
But there's room for doubt with many, and there's about six or seven that still has everyone scratching their heads. They don't know what they are. So my reason for writing this book basically was that the narrow focus on establishing solutions, that only takes you so far. I mean, there's one good scholar whose name eludes me now in the 70s, who said something that really has stuck with me, that the riddle only becomes interesting after you solve it. That, you know, it's one thing to unpick the lock and come up with, this means that. But that's only that's the starting point. And that really going back then with the solution in mind and seeing how all the twisty turns really play is what lights it up in a big way. And that's why I didn't mind putting the titles, you know, the solutions as the titles for each of these, because it's not about, oh, I wonder what this is. Oh, there it is. You know, that's just like a joke that, you know, the punchline, so it's not a joke anymore. But they really get interesting as poetry.
Yes, you know. Well, they do. And, you know, this strange kind of collaboration between folk tradition and oral tradition and Christianity and monks working hard in a scriptorium in a monastery. You know, it's a very strange sort of coming together of very different elements.
Sure. And again, you really have to wonder. I mean, I talked about this in my Beowulf book, that poem should never have got composed or written down using the resources of a Christian medieval scriptorium. And the riddles in some ways, are even more puzzling, because there's about three or four, well, there's riddles that are blatantly about sex. You know, they're definitely viewer discretion of, or reader discretion advised in that way. And they all have innocent solutions, but yeah, well, why would a monastery use its costly resources of labor and materials to record stuff like that? What were they thinking of? We don't know.
Well, maybe they were more humorous than we imagine them.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah. A bit more light. We've only got a few minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
What other things should we take note about in the riddle tradition of Old English that is saved in this one book, the Old Exeter text?
Well, I guess as a final summary assessment, I would suggest that the riddle is closer to the beating heart of the poetic tradition than most scholarship recognizes. They tend to treat it as a peripheral thing. As a peripheral epiphenomenon almost. And, you know, they knew riddles, so they copied a few down and they were just mucking around. But I think there's something much more serious. You know, well, I hesitate to say more serious because they are playful.
More profound.
But profound, certainly. And I think there's something about the way Old English poetry itself works. Some of the most common figures of speech in Old English poetry, the so-called kennings, are kind of mini riddles. So, you know the famous ones that everybody who knows about this stuff knows, things like the Hronrad is literally the whale, as in cetacean sea creature, road. The road of the whale is the sea. And so that's it doesn't take long, but it's a figure of speech that has a riddly aspect to it. And it maybe that's how Anglo-Saxon poets thought, as a matter of course. So it might not be as playfully peripheral a phenomenon as we might think at first.
Yeah, no, I think they're very profound, and I think it's a wonderful thing that they've captured this moment of Old English writing and thinking that existed in this remote time, 1500 years ago, and somehow it's come down to us. So it's a rare and special thing. Thank you for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
So I've been talking to Robert De Napoli about his new book, Reading Old English Riddles, The Dark Glass, which is published by the Cambridge Scholars Press. Mm-hmm. And my name is Di Cousins, and this has been the Spoken Word program. And we're just going to hear a bit of music from a new CD by the Van Diemen's Band with Ensemble Kabul. And the CD is entitled Where Everything is Music, and this is a section of the track of Nocien No. 1 by Eric Satie.